Then I finished and sent the book off to my editor, who at the time was Harriet McDougall, who, by sheer coincidence, is the wife of Robert Jordan, the author of the Wheel of Time series, though at that time he was still writing Conan stories for Tom Doherty. The Wheel of Time had not started appearing. And so, you know, it's a very incestuous small world in science fiction. Harriet was thrilled with the book. She thought it was wonderful, and she was as excited as I was. They were so excited that Tom decided that as they started a new hardcover line, because at that time Tor was only a paperback publisher, they published nothing in hardcover, they were going to have their first novel in hardcover be Ender's Game in December of 1984. Well, this is what my ambition for this novel was at the time. I called up my editor and I said, Harriet, we can't release it. You know, I'm flattered to be the first hardcover, but we can't do that. If you put it out in December of 84, that's right at the end of the Hugo eligibility time period, the year. And if the year ends and they start nominating in as they do in January, no one will have read Ender's Game. Nobody buys a hardcover that comes out in December, certainly not science fiction readers. They're all poor. They wait till it comes out in paperback. So if you just wait and bring out the hardcover in January of 85, then it'll have the whole year in hardcover, and the paperback can come out before the nominations, and this book will have a chance at making the ballot. If you bring it out in hardcover in December, no chance. It'll just disappear as far as the awards are concerned. Well, she saw the reasoning of that. They brought out a book by another author, I believe Gordon Dixon, as their first book in December of their first hardcover in December of 84. And Ender's Game came out in January of 1985. And the eligibility worked as I had hoped. It had time for readers to discover it. And the result was that it was on the ballot and ended up winning the Hugo Award, which is what I was aiming for. I was stunned when it also won the Nebula Award. It seemed to me too popular a kind of novel, a novel too much aimed at the common denominator of readers to win the Nebula. So I was naturally thrilled when it won that award as well. And then Speaker for the Dead, the sequel, went on to win both awards also the following year. But I didn't set out to write a Hugo-winning book, but I was able to tell when I was finished with writing Ender's Game that it was the kind of story that would be in contention. That was 20 years ago. Since then, of course, immediately attention came from Hollywood. As a matter of fact, it was the short story that prompted the first option that a movie producer took on Ender's Game. The novel was out, but he hadn't read it. He didn't know about it. He had read the short story only. And it was the same producer who had produced or who was at that point working on Enemy Mine, a story by Barry Longyear, which was based in turn on Hell in the Pacific, which was a movie. So adapting a story that was based on a movie into a movie again, you would have thought it would be foolproof. But instead, Enemy Mine tanked, and that original option on Ender's Game expired along with the producer's sources of funding. But that first option taught me a valuable lesson. Because as soon as the option was signed, what the producer said to me was, of course, we have to change Ender to be 16 years old and give him a love interest. And I was horrified. I said, first of all, these kids are supposed to be geniuses. If Ender is 16, there is no 16-year-old with even half a brain who is going to believe everything that adults tell him. Ender has to be so young and have lived in such a sheltered environment that he still believes everything that adults tell him. And 16-year-olds aren't like that. Especially not really smart 16-year-olds, especially not the kind of 16-year-olds with the initiative and the brain power to save the world as a military commander. But they wouldn't listen to me. And why? And it wasn't just this producer. It was producer after producer over the next few years. After that option expired, everybody that came to me said, well, of course, we can't leave Ender as a little kid. And they would all explain to me why. First of all, they had to get that date audience. How in the world will we make the money back on this movie unless we have people on dates? And people on dates need 16, 17, 18-year-old heroes. They need to see themselves. You know, nobody that age, you know, nobody in their teens is going to care about what happens to a 6 or 9 or 10-year-old kid. I said, well, wait a minute. What about E.T.? You know, where's the teen hero in E.T.? It was a huge hit. Well, that was a special movie, they would tell me. I said, great, let's make Ender's Game a special movie too. Well, apparently they didn't have the vision to see how that would work. The real problem, and this one was not just Hollywood silliness, is that when you have a movie that absolutely depends on a child actor, you're shooting yourself in the foot. Because how many good child actors have there been? I'm not talking about child actors who were in hit movies. I'm talking about children who can really, really act. There have been a few. Elijah Wood was a child actor like that. Obviously, Haley Joel Osment. A couple of others further back, Roddy McDowall, marvelous child actor, and others whose names are slipping my mind right now. But there's never been more than one at a time in any given year. I mean, in order to make The Good Son, they had to cast Elijah Wood with Macaulay Culkin, which means you had a face and a talented actor. And, you know, that was what was going to happen to Ender's Game. Well, Ender's Game, to be filmed, needed not just Ender, but a half dozen other kids to be excellent, excellent actors. It's almost an impossible thing to do. In fact, it still was a worry, even after Ender's Game was subsequently optioned very seriously in the project that's going on right now. Still a concern until I saw the movie Peter Pan, the live-action Peter Pan directed by Hogan. In that film, it absolutely depends on the performance of children. And yes, the character of Peter Pan was cast the kid has a marvelous look, a magical look, but the director got a good performance out of him. And all the other kids gave excellent performances. All the Lost Boys, the Indian Princess, the brothers and Wendy, they gave wonderful performances. It can be done. And that encouraged me no end. But by then, Ender's Game was under the option that finally worked. But here's how that came about. Probably more than you're going to want to know, but they told me I could talk as long as I wanted to, and then they'd still manage to fit it onto 9 CDs. Either that or they'll edit out these comments too, so you won't even hear them. So if you do hear them, you know that they kept their promise and everything that I wanted to say is in here. But I was obviously still shopping this around and saying no to everybody, because everybody would say, we got to make Ender 16. And I would say, no, it's got to be in the contract that you don't have any right to make this movie if Ender is played any older than 12. In fact, I specified he has to be played as being under 12 years of age. I wanted it so that there was no chance of puberty rearing its ugly head. I didn't want to have any chance that they would give Ender a date during the movie. I didn't want him to fall in love with anybody. I wanted him to be a boy, a kid. To me, that was essential. So I would insist that they include that clause. And I had a couple who agreed, okay, we'll do it that way. We'll put in that clause. But then I would read the contract, and these were, you know, Hollywood contracts, so they were thicker than most novels. And sure enough, you know, 40 pages later into the contract, there'd be a little clause buried in the middle of a paragraph that had nothing to do with this subject that said, contrary to any statement anywhere else in this contract, Ender may be played at any age, or, you know, casting will be solely at the discretion, et cetera, et cetera. Something that erased that clause so that I would see the visible clause, and they hoped that I wouldn't notice the clause later in the contract that said that they didn't have to do it after all. Well, you know, that told me that not only couldn't I sign that contract, I didn't want to work with these people. Contrary to public opinion, you don't have to be dishonest to work in Hollywood. In fact, most people who are really dishonest in Hollywood fail, because a collaborative project like any good movie absolutely depends on trust. There are lots and lots of crooks in Hollywood, but very few of them are making movies. The people who are making good movies are honest people. They're able to maintain the level of trust with their fellow workers that enables everybody to do their best work. So I wasn't going to do any business with those guys. Then there were the other guys who would say they would use their best efforts to play Ender as being under 12 years. Well, best efforts means at some point, long before shooting starts, two guys are sitting in a conference room in the studio and they say, well, what do you think? Should Ender be under 12? And the other guy would go, nah. And that's it. That was best efforts right there, because they'd say, well, we couldn't do it. The studio executives wouldn't do it, and they're the ones with the money. So we did our best efforts, but Ender's going to be 16 now. So that clause didn't work. And then there were the people who said, whose contract said, we'll make Ender under 12, give or take 4 years. Well, I can add, you know, I didn't think they were going to make him under 8. That was solely designed to make it so that he could be played as a 16-year-old. So once again, not doing business with these guys. Finally, I found the producer who got it. And that's the producer that I ended up originally signing with long before the current option with the studio. That producer was Robert Chartoff. Ted Ravenette, a friend of his who was a play producer and a film producer, had found Ender's Game, brought it to Chartoff, and Chartoff read it, loved it, and they got it. They knew that Ender had to be played under 12, and they understood why. And they were going to fight for that. And Robert Chartoff's producing partner, Lynn Hendy, who is a marvelous producer and a joy to work with, and became the active producer on this, the one that I worked most closely with. She got it, and they agreed that I would write the screenplay. And in order to sell the project, I wrote screenplays for which I was not paid. Officially, I'm not supposed to do that, but I wasn't union labor, and I was adapting my own books. So, I sort of fit in through the cracks. I wrote one draft, and it was a good draft. But the heart wasn't there, and we didn't understand why. No, none of us were understanding what wasn't working. It wasn't what I left out. It wasn't that I was too faithful to the original book. In fact, I sometimes appalled them by how unfaithful I was. But I knew what the essence of the story was, and so I was able to strip away a lot of things that really weren't necessary. But somehow the emotions just weren't coming through. People would read the book and be thrilled, and then they'd read the screenplay, and they'd go, it's just not there. And they couldn't say why.